I don't know whether the media people, but we are going to just do a quick introduction so that we know who's here today. Otherwise, you are welcome into this meeting. In our agenda, we have got only two items. I've welcomed you already. I'll request the secretary to present apologies, if we do have any apologies.
Apology from Mom Gorman. She's not feeling well. Mamu Bam and Mamu Nisi and also Mr. Magloa.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think let's add the Honorable who's Machoba. They've got a special meeting we cooked. And I think for Honorable Gorman, she had an accident. I spoke to her last night. Yeah, I'm sure she's still shocked, but she's at home. She's not admitted. Let's hope that she's going to recover very soon. But she told us that she's missing this meeting, but she's going to try to recover. I don't know how she's going to try, because I don't think it's on her hands. Depends on her. But we hope that she's going to be okay by next week. Just to briefly indicate what is on the agenda today, we are expecting a report from the department on the SIU activities. Members will recall that I think it was beginning of the year or end of last year, the minister came before the portfolio committee and advised the committee that because of the commitment and in response to the State of the Nation address on the priorities of government, of which one of them is combating and crime and corruption. So we also understand that in the human settlements division, we had quite a lot of challenges that are reported by the communities to the portfolio committee, even to the department per se, around the dissatisfaction on the service delivery on housing. And we do have some reports from the Auditor General at some stage. We will find that there are issues that are raised by the Auditor General in respect to the so-called maladministration at the level of the housing delivery. So the minister took a decision to appoint the Auditor General as well to work with the SIU to ensure that these issues are investigated, these allegations, because those are allegations, as long as they are not proven. So today we are expecting to have that report. We were supposed to have it in at least, because we normally have the reports from the portfolio committee, I mean from the department. We are supposed to have quarterly reports on some issues, but I think we have given them enough time to ensure that they are doing their work appropriately, so that they can come and report today at least the progress that has been made. We know that is not the end of part one. They are still continuing with their work. So, DG, over to you and your team. And they were in our, we also have this voucher scheme program. Yeah. I think this one has been long in our agenda. So, we are expecting you to report on it. But let's have a quick introduction first. Let's start by Honorable Keta.
Sanibona, my name is Keta Mabala Todd. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee.
Good morning, Roy Bula, member of this committee.
I'm Shane. My name is Richard Mdahan, a member of the committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Butch Stein, and I think by virtue of my presence here, I'm a member of the committee.
Morning. My name is Mashishi, a member of the committee.
Dumelang, I'm Professor Bon, a member of the committee.
Morning, my name is Prince Wapase, Committee Secretary.
Good morning,
Millie Lekava, Deputy
Director General. Morning, my name is Neville Cheney, Department of Human Settlement, Chief of Operations.
Morning, members. My name is Tabane Zulukiji, Human Settlement.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Louis van der Walt from the Human Settlements National Department, and I'm responsible for policy development.
Good morning. My name is Jan Maritz. I'm also from the National Department of Human Settlements in the Housing Entities Unit.
Good morning. My name is Kumuyisile Khaisale. I'm the Chief Director of Internal Audit, Risk Management and Special Investigations in the Department of Human Settlements.
You are welcome, Honorable Ndobe. I take this opportunity to introduce you. No, you are not late. DG, over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our position that we want to deal in terms of SIU, the report back, as requested, I think it's important that we did not anticipate that as your request will come before SIU will ask us to do a media brief on what they've done. So I know that members would have preferred to have had a first-hand information before the media a second stage on the matter. I want to say in advance that was beyond our control. We have prepared, and I'm sure by the time at least By the time the media briefing took place, I'm sure you would have received the document and you might have gone through it. We tried to submit it last week. Hopefully, you might have scanned it before it was reported on the media. But it was our intention that before it's presented to media, at least you have a chance to engage with yourselves and give you a background to the matter. I wanted to just make that point, Madam Chair.
Well, I apologize, accepted. Otherwise, I decided to keep quiet this time. I'm happy that you acknowledged that.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Chair. I felt bad when the media, when FIU was saying the media arrangement has been made, because I said, my goodness, I haven't briefed the committee on this one, and the next thing they'll see it on television and in media papers, having not seen the content of it. So it was beyond our control. I'll ask the members to bear with us on that one. Madam Chair, last year November, the National Audit Task Team was established. As you know, that the minister was quite concerned about what he found to be an unacceptable standard of corruption and fraud in the department. And the task team was mainly to basically continue with the work that the FIU had started in 2007. And it was mainly to give more impetus into the work that has been done and to provide more leadership and direction in terms of what needs to be done moving forward. I think it's fair to say that the sector will have to deal with this for a pretty long time. There is a lot of work that needs to be done. We have decided as a department on annual basis to budget for this particular exercise. It's not free of charge, as much as SIU is part of government and what they're doing, but for everything that they do, we must pay them. I think it's important to note that. But as a department, we felt it correct to make sure that we budget for this exercise. And some money has already been spent. We'll give you details of the figures at some point. This year, they've requested an amount of 35 million, which they wanted us to budget. This is informed by the bulk of work that they need to do to deal with a number of queries, a number of investigations that they have to undertake on behalf of the department. We are negotiating with them an amount of 20 million because our budget is not currently sound to spend a lot of money on this. All that you are trying to do, the department, is to provide guidance, is to provide leadership in terms of which specific key areas do we think are critical so that we also minimize our cost. So this is a report that we are giving to you, which has been done by FIU together with our internal team under the leadership of Khumusi Tsile from Chief Director Internal Audit. She is in charge of this particular work and over and above the internal audit work that we do in the department. She works closely with the FIU under the leadership of Vanessa, who couldn't be here today. In the near future, we'd also like FIU members to be part of this meeting, so should there be more in-depth questions in terms of the real issues that we deal with, we were able to respond adequately. I must also say that as you have read the report, it's very high level. It doesn't speak to specifics. It's deliberate because some of the issues are under investigation, and we do not want to expose the strategy, the thinking, the way forward in terms of the actual issues that SIU is dealing with, because that could jeopardize even the work that we're doing. And you'll also notice that in the media briefing itself, the minister and Wilhoff Mayor and myself, we tried not to be specific in the manner in which we report on certain issues so as to protect other processes that are currently underway insofar as the investigations are taking place. But overall, Madam Chair and honorable members, we are very happy with the work that has been done overall. I think happy in the sense that at least some action has been taken, a message has been said, some people have been arrested, some companies have been found to be not doing the correct things, and it sends a positive message from our sector that we are in business and we
we mean business in terms of making sure that the money that is set to do what it should do that. And if anything is found unwanting, we must be able to act decisively and send a positive message. Overall, we are therefore very happy. That is why, even in this current financial year, we have put aside a budget to continue this exercise, because this has been happening for a very long time, and our intervention will then assist us even in the future housing projects that we are doing. It also helps us to begin to see where are the gaps in terms of our own monitoring and inspection as a department insofar as specific areas that we are dealing with. It's within that context that therefore we have agreed to continue with this engagement with SIU. So Kumu will just take you through the specifics, the detail, as well as the figures in terms of what has been done to date, and then the honorable members can then ask questions to that effect. I'll then ask Kumu to take us through the presentation. Over to you, Kumu.
Thank you. The presentation, the summary of the presentation is just the background review with performance reports that were issued by the Auditor General 2006-2008 and the action plan. We'll deal with the SIU mandate, the operating model, and the letter proclamation R7, the initial one, and the extension R25-2010. The SIU focus areas. We'll also deal with the progress on investigations on non-qualifying beneficiaries, ministerial hotline referrals, syndicates, contractors, and procurement. And I will also deal with the proposed way forward about the contract investigations under the National Auditors Team. The highlights will deal with the recovery direct and the disciplinary action issues. The background is members already know. There were two reports that were issued by the Auditor General. One in 2006 that dealt with the irregular access to RVP houses by the government officials. The 2008 report dealt with the municipal employees who also obtained low-income housing unauthorized. During the previous financial year, the AG did some follow-up on some of the work that was done, and further work was done on a selective basis, and they found more. They have given us more findings, which the department is currently looking into. As we all know, that in a way of dealing with these issues that were raised by the Auditor General reports, the department sought a comprehensive approach to deal with the issues, and this led to the establishment of the relationship between the department and the Special Investigating Unit, as the DG has mentioned. The Presidential Proclamation, which was published in April 2007, is the initial proclamation that was signed when the relationship between the department and the SIU began. This mandated the SIU to conduct national investigations into the matters raised in the report of corruption and fraud with regard to the allocation of housing. And now, in July, the President signed another proclamation, R35, that extends the mandate to the end of July. The operating model of the that has been agreed to between the department and the SIU is that the proclamation, as you know, gives the SIU an independent operational mandate where they report to the President and to Parliament. The work that we have agreed, the SLA, the service level agreement that we have signed, we have a 5-year a service level agreement to deal with the subsidies, and we have a 3-year SLA to deal with the contracts and the contract investigations. Under the proclamation, the SIU, the investigations will be looking at the administration of low income housing subsidies, administration and implementation of low income housing scheme, loss of state funds, mismanagement or misuse of the low-income housing scheme, and the conduct of government officials resulting in the lack of control over the scheme. The focus areas for the investigations, as I said, the priority one was the subsidies. We dealt with the 2006 AG report, which focused on the government employees who defrauded the system. And here the objective was to really establish the accuracy of the AG's findings and identify reasons for payments to non-qualifying beneficiaries and initiate and facilitate legal action on those cases where it is found that irregular activities have occurred and recover funds paid to non-qualifying beneficiaries. This also is the same objective that was followed for the municipal employees as per the report of the AG issued in 2008. Further focus, which is priority two, deals with the contract, which is the new area that the SIU now will be dealing with. Here, the main focus is to look at the abuse of low-income housing project overpayments to contractors, inferior quality, and non-delivery of houses. The objective here is to gain an understanding of which housing projects are problematic nationally, and to identify the typologies and trends of various abuses that have occurred and determine preventative measures, facilitate the enforcement of the outstanding contractual obligations where contractors have not fully delivered, and recover payments from contractors who were paid but not delivered anything, and all those that have delivered shoddy workmanship, and then pursue officials and third parties who are implicated in this misconduct. And also, what is always important is for us to say that out of what we have found through the investigations, identify where the gaps are in our policies and make recommendations to close those gaps and to improve on our systems. Further to the contractors, the investigation should also be looking at the syndicates because from looking at the contractors and the subsidies, it also became apparent that there are syndicates operating within this whole corruption activity where people are renting and selling the houses, and issues of procurement where appointment of contractors, maybe the irregularities that have occurred, they would also be looking at that. And some of the issues related to the issues that were reported directly to the ministerial hotline. And here the objective is actually to deal with, to determine who's responsible for the renting and sale of these houses, identify the procurement irregularities and hold people accountable, and then establish if there's any merit in information received from the informants, the people that are sending, that are blowing the whistle through the ministerial hotline, so that we can determine whether these cases are investigatable or not. And we also make sure that we provide feedback to the informants where we have contacts of the people that have reported issues. The profile of the investigation on the subsidies related to fraudulent activities, like where people misrepresented their employment status, their income levels, their marital status, and the income of their spouses. The other cases revealed that there are overpayments that have occurred where the incorrect subsidy types were selected, and where there were errors in the processing of the applications. The key findings of the AG report were due to the fact that when the AG report was analyzed to determine what were the reasons that, because we know that the AG report highlighted about 7.3 cases where the government officials have defrauded the department, but it was important that in order to investigate these cases to determine whether the factuality of those findings, but we found that most of the findings were there because the AG used the approval date instead of the application date as per the systems of the department. And when we analyzed the findings out of the AG report on the government employees, we at this stage we have completed those investigations, We found that out of the number that we could get records for, 49%, only 49% was found to be irregular, and 51% were actually beneficiaries who qualified. And the same was done on the municipal report, where we found that of the files that could be found, 70% were found to be qualifying beneficiaries, and only 30% were found to be irregular. So the reason why the figures here on the report, if you look at the AG report, we are saying we looked at 4,413 cases, and the municipalities, we looked at 5,440 instead of the 7.3 and the 6,000, is because the provinces could not provide some of the files. And this actually gives a skewed report on the percentages that we are doing, because we are basing it not on the complete number of reports that the AG found. And this, the reason is that there's poor records management at the provinces, but this matter is currently being dealt with through the Joint Steering Committee meeting. The department has just established this committee to deal with, which is the Joint Steering Committee meeting, where progress is followed up with the provinces on the investigations that are currently being done. As I have mentioned earlier, that in doing all these investigations, one needs to also determine what are the root causes for this, and these are the gaps that maybe are there in our act or in our policies, and to maybe make recommendations for improvement onto this system. And so the department also has dealt with these issues, where we found that people were misrepresenting. We have enhanced the application verification, and we have a relationship with the Home Affairs to look at the population database, with the UIF to look at the employment status of the people, so that to deal with the issues where people are misrepresenting their employment and income status. The overpayments, we have introduced a second level of authorization on the HSS to make sure that just to strengthen the checks and balances on the system. And the accountability of officials has been increased by upgrading the filing system, which is what we are dealing with on a month-by-month basis during our Joint Steering Committee meeting. And with the Home Affairs also to look at the fictitious IDs, so we do those ID validations as well. And we've increased controls on the database, on the HSS database. Further to that, we've also recommended some revisions on the application forms to ensure that issues of the signatures and the printing of the names, so that we can be able to determine who processed the application forms. One other issue that was found out is that as Section 4.6 of the Housing Act, it indicates that the code shall be binding on the provincial and local spheres of government. However, we found that the Housing Act does not create an offence or a sanction under this section, where this section has not been complied with. Hence, the officials that do not comply with it, it's very difficult to prosecute them to make this an illegal act. So there's recommendations that have been made to the department to actually look at that section to make sure that it is enhanced. And we are continuously improving on our HS system to prevent further abuse of the system. As the DG had indicated, in November, the minister instituted the National Auditors Team. This is a way of making sure that the investigations that we are doing in the department are very comprehensive and deal with all matters, not only focusing on subsidies, but all matters that are raised in terms of the abuse of the system and the irregularities that are occurring with the delivery of housing. And amongst some of the issues that are dealt with under the National Auditor's Team is matters that are referred through the ministerial hotline. So far, 23 referrals have been received, and two of these referrals have been finalized, and some other cases under investigation. However, some of the cases, as I had indicated that we do determine whether there's factuality in some of the cases that are reported by the whistleblowers. In some cases, we found that we cannot continue with the cases because because the whistleblowers remain anonymous as is allowed by the law, we are unable to go back and get further details to actually focus our investigations. And in some cases, the whistleblowers also do not fear to give more information at some point. So those are the kind of challenges that we are met with dealing with the hotline referrals. It also came out that there are syndicates that are dealing with that are involved in the corrupt activities with the delivery of houses, and these were found to be mostly operating in Gauteng, Northwestern, KwaZulu-Natal. These cases really deal with those people that are selling the houses, and there's counselors that are implicated there, where houses are sold between 6,000 and 25,000 rand. And these cases are really currently being investigated, and some progress has been made, where in KZN, three arrests have been made, and further arrests will be made as well. However, witnesses are also scared to make a statement because they will lose the houses. So there are those challenges that are there with these investigations as well. With the contracts, what was done initially was to go to the provinces to do a systems walkthrough to obtain an understanding of how the system for appointment of contractors operates, so that we can find the key control areas to determine what would have gone wrong, such that we have these kind of problems where contractors do not deliver. So provinces were given the reports to make management comments, and we are struggling a little bit with the provinces to get some of the feedback on these reports, but on a monthly basis we are dealing with these issues through the JSC meeting. We have identified some weaknesses in the system that the department is nationally is being used with the appointment of contractors, and these matters have been raised, and they will be looked at. We have conducted an in-depth analysis of around 9,000 projects to identify the projects that are problematic for investigation. And out of those 9,000 projects, the list was brought down to about 100 contracts that were found to be cases that they may be problematic. Out of the 100 contracts, we prioritized 20 contracts nationally to be dealt with in the current financial year of 2010-11, and this is spread. These contracts are spread across the provinces. So these investigations are currently underway. We have just begun working on these cases, so we don't have results as yet. We talked about the National Audit Task Team that has been set up, under which these cases of contractors and syndicates are dealt with. We have, further to that, out of the contractors, there's on the analysis of the contractors, of the contract, there's so far two cases that have been, that we are currently looking at with the Directorate of Public Prosecutions, just to determine whether we can to determine the possibility of issuing warrant of arrest for some of the contractors, where we found that at face value we think that we can bring these people to book. The key outcomes of all these investigations really is to ensure that contractors really perform according to their contractual obligations. We address also improper conduct emanating from non-delivery. The potential legal outcome is that we will be claiming damages, enforcing a payment back from the contractors, with the SIU assisting us, we'll be facilitating criminal action against the contractors who are implicated and third parties, and for officials, we'll be recommending disciplinary action for those government officials who are implicated. We'll be ensuring that also those contractors that have defrauded the system, they should be restricted. They should be sort of blacklisted from the supplier database of government, and National Treasury, we are currently discussing with National Treasury on the procedure to make sure that they're on the national database for blacklisted contractors, so that they do not do business with any of the government departments or provincially. The investigation of the contract, we have done the data analysis, we've done the walkthrough. Now the investigation is starting. What we did under data analysis, we selected high-risk contracts with specific allegations. We looked at prescription issues. We've also looked at the electronic data analysis to determine the trend. We asked the provinces to provide to us contracts that they feel are problematic so that we can prioritize them. And we collected documents to do the walkthrough. And then with the investigation, we'll be identifying the red flags for corruption and also including the procurement appointment of those contractors. And we'll also be interrogating the details in the contract to determine whether the contractors have really complied with the contractual obligations there and how the contracts have been managed by the provinces as well. And the action that we'll be taking is that we'll be ensuring that we recover monies, and disciplinary action is taken, and prosecution, disciplinary actions against officials of government, and prosecution for the contractors that have defrauded the department. The way forward is that we have commenced with the investigation to 20 contracts for this financial year. The team, because this is very technical investigations, the SIU needs to put together a team of experts, your engineers, your special forensic investigators. Because in investigating whether there's delivery, you will also be looking at the shoddy workmanship. So you need technical expertise to be able to determine whether there's value for money on the products that are on the ground. So the SIU has had to really increase their capacity to make sure that it's aligned with the kind of activities that they would be required to perform in doing this investigation. And parallel to this investigation, we'll also be at the same time continuing with the restrictions on contractors that are found to have done wrong. And the other point is that to deal with matters of conflict of interest, the department is currently working together with the SIU to develop a disclosure database at the department where all the officials will disclose, and this will be electronically captured in the department so that on an annual basis this is checked against all the work that is done on investigation. We'll also be cleansing the system, the HSS system. And the other matter is also to deal with the capacity, the skills capacity of the project management teams at the provinces for this project, to ensure that the projects are properly managed and inspections are properly done. Under the procurement investigations, we have found that there are a number of cases that have come to light. About 62 officials have been identified that are doing business with the department nationally, provincially, and municipality level, and that's the disclosure database that will help us to actually make sure that these are identified before they become problems. And so we are also looking at the issues of where maybe there are some conflict of interest identified and dealing with those issues. We identified 14 service providers that were using the same VAT number. This matter is currently being dealt with in conjunction with SARS to actually get the facts correct so that we can prosecute these service providers. The highlights of the project, under subsidies, so far 930 officials have been arrested. We have signed around 1,600 acknowledgement of debt to the value of 21.7 million. About 1,000 disciplinary files have been prepared, and these are being distributed to the departments where the officials are appointed at national level. The DPSA will be distributing the files to the national departments where the officials are appointed at the provincial level. The distribution is done through the premier's offices. This is there's a task team that is put together between the department and the DPSA to deal with the disciplinary files to make sure that there's consistency in the sanctions that are meted out to the people, to the officials that are, have been found guilty. Under the municipal employees, 292 municipal employees have been arrested so far. 710 acknowledgement of debt to the value of 6.7 million have been signed, and over and above the red flags that were identified by the Auditor General, the SIU had identified further numbers. The Auditor General had identified 7.3. The SIU, when they did further analysis, they came up to about 30,000 officials, and that's what the SIU red flags they refer to. So they are on parallel to what they are currently doing. They are also looking to the into the red flags that they identified themselves. And in that category, they've already 544 beneficiaries have been arrested. Around 1,000 AODs signed to the value of 13 million, and 256 disciplinary files have been prepared. Together, to this point, about 40 million rand has been recovered. And when we say recovered, we mean when the acknowledgement of debt are signed, the people are given a period of 60-month payment period. So the value that 40 million rand refers to what we have signed, what we are, will be recovering in future, because they pay on a monthly basis. But what we have collected so far is around 11 million. And once the collection is done, regularly the SIU does their reconciliations. And once they are done with the reconciliation, they pay back the money to the department. So far, money that has already been paid back to the department is around 5 million. And I think by the end of this month or next month, we'll be getting further payments back to the department. With the contract in KZN, there's a convincing attorney that was that has been charged with around 142 counts of fraud, and this total to about 2 million. There's also three officials that have been arrested, and they will be appearing before court for their involvement with the syndicate activities, and the restriction process of about now stands at around 40 contractors that is being finalized currently. We said that this is going to be done by engaging National Treasury. We have those two cases that are being reviewed by the DPP's office, and we're expecting to make arrests as soon as all the documents and information has been verified. And the quote from Nelson Mandela, when the water starts boiling, it is foolish to turn off the heat. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think
you
need to add
something. I think that is the background in terms of what has been done so far, as I've indicated. This is the work that has been done. I think it's quite clear. The stats is also correct and confirmed. It's more or less the same media briefing that you have done, focused mainly in the areas that the presentation has covered as well.
Okay. Time for interacting and direction. Honorable Day, Honorable Lagude, Honorable Mashishi, Honorable Bula, Honorable Njobe, Honorable Tole, and then the whip. Okay, before the whip,
Honorable Khatibone, and then Louis. Honorable Sting, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just for the record, Honorable Bowman said I could have a question time as well.
It's not recorded anywhere.
Chair, thank you to the department for this. I just want to say, first of all, you remember we visited the department 2 weeks ago, almost 3 weeks ago now, when we did our oversight. And I was taken around, as were many of my colleagues, around the building. And what struck me was when I got to the floor where the internal audit or investigation unit is, I came to the conclusion that the department is not taking their own internal investigation unit serious. It was an open plan office. There were files lying around that should be locked up. And in fact, some of the people I spoke to said that they had a problem, in that they often have very sensitive information that they are busy investigating that is accessible to anybody that can walk through there and that has access to it. And I want to make a plea to the Director General that if we are serious about fighting corruption, then we should give certainly your own internal unit a little bit more resources. They should be in a place within the department where there is some form of security so that people don't have access to very sensitive information. That was just by way of introduction, Chair. Then I'm going to start with, it's a number of times now that we've had the report, obviously that emanates from the Auditor General's report of 2006-2007. And as far as that particular one is concerned, nothing new has come to light. The figures remain more or less the same, the 1,007 or 1,900 people. And yet, if we look at the numbers that were highlighted, it says the 2006 report highlighted 7,353. And yet, even to date, this is the latest report, only 4,413 cases were ended over for investigation. Excuse me. Similarly with the municipalities. A total of between 2006 and 2008, there were 14,000 cases highlighted. But if you look at the results, like I say, in the case of the 2006 report, there was 4,413 cases handed over. That's out of 7,300. For the municipalities, 6,900 were handed over, and there was 5,400 cases handled. So, you know, I'd like to know what is happening to the balance. Is it simply been, you know, is there simply no resources to carry on with it? Then, I'm just going in order of the presentation, Chair. On the systematic recommendations, whilst I accept that the Housing Act may not create an offence or a sanction if a certain portion of it has not been complied with, I would imagine that there are other pieces of legislation that deal with it, because if it is binding on an official to conform to something in the Act, then they actually don't. The Act doesn't need to say that you will be sent to jail or fire or fined. There are normal processes that should come into play here, whether it's that they're not performing in terms of their contract or something like that. So I don't think we should sit back and wait for a piece of legislation to be amended. There are other avenues that should be investigated to deal with those issues. We can't sit back and say, well, they're not complying, so, and the Act doesn't say anything. I think that is very serious, and it's upon certainly the department to look at what else can be used in order to discipline or sanction those people guilty of that. Then, Chair, what I'd like to know in terms of the hotline referrals, a total of 23, over what period? Did it start in 2007 up to 2009? And then only two have been finalized. Again, what was the result of the two? They may have been finalized where nothing was found, or were people prosecuted? Was there actually something that was found that could have led to something, a more serious investigation? And then just on the SIU approach in terms of the nine provinces, the walkthrough they're talking about, if at some point in the future we could get a presentation on that as well, what was the findings? How does the nine provinces... Because what they did, they looked at the understanding of the system of the provinces in appointment of contractors. I think we'd like to know as well, because it may vary from province to province. And there may very well be something that we need to tighten up in legislation as a result of that. So I'm asking that at some point in the future that we be given that presentation as well. Then, Chair, the one thing, and it's a very general one, and it refers to the earlier employees as well. There's a large number of employees that are being referred for disciplinary hearings. Now, we all know that these things take an awful long time. It could take years while the people are still in their place of employment, while they can manipulate evidence and so on. In some cases, surely, if it is once again found that it is a criminal act, again, I think the owner should be on the department that they should not necessarily want to follow a disciplinary way. If it's a criminal act, they should be charged. And it should be taken to the, you know, the law must take its course rather than waiting for a disciplinary hearing that can take 2 or 5 years. And at the end of that, in fact, before the result is out, the employee just simply resigns and at the end of it. So again, I'm asking for more focused, more, we don't have the resources all the time. We need to find means and ways of dealing with these things so that we also send the message out, not just that we're investigating, but that there's an end result and there's a penalty at the end of the day. Something that I'd like an answer on is the blacklisting of contractors, and the committee has asked for this before. But does it go far enough? You know, if I'm a contractor that's guilty of something and I'm being blacklisted, what happens if I simply recreate the company under my brother-in-law's name or something to that effect, my wife's name even, and reapply? Is there a mechanism in place where we can go beyond just the original directors via their ID documents, where there's close relationships between them and other family members? And obviously, I'm not suggesting at all that simply because my brother-in-law may have a company that he should be blacklisted. But at least there should be a process whereby it gets investigated. Was it established after I was blacklisted, for example? Is it the same type of operation? So I think that should be taken further as well. Otherwise, we're simply going to get companies changing directors and doing the same thing over and over. Chair, I'm going to leave some for a second round, if I may. Safe to say... I just want to, well, then I'm going to carry on, Chair. The whip has just said there's no second round. I just want to say one other thing before I get the second bite at it. There's mention about the whistleblowers. Now, Chair, and I'm not going to mention names or anything like that, but as you know, I have referred something to the minister that he's indicated to me in writing has been handed over to the SI unit, going on 3 months now. One of my informants, and I've informed the minister, has received a telephonic call that threatened his life. The information is with the minister. None of my informants have been contacted. I have not been contacted. So I'm not too sure if this whistleblowing thing is being taken serious, and that may be why people are reluctant to come forward. I've impressed upon the minister that I've had a court case, a number with the police open for that particular threat. I forwarded that to the minister's office as well. To date, nothing has happened. I've also informed the minister. Now, I can appreciate the workload. And with contract that was done 5 and 10 years ago, there's not much you can do other than follow a paper trail. But in the instance that I'm talking about, Chair, the paper trail is fresh. I've told the minister, my informant says, that the evidence is being tampered with and destroyed, and yet nothing is being done. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. We all know that staying is the who by ships almost everything. Definitely, I still have some few questions to ask. You mentioned something about recovering these payments from contractors. My question is, how are you going to do that with those contractors who are broke? Because we all know that some of the people who are corrupt don't have anything to show after a year or two. Then I also want to know from the officials and municipal employees, how are you planning to recover those millions? Then with provinces where you said records and files couldn't be found, then I want to know if this means that those provinces are cleared of corruption of this sort. Thank you, Chair.
Who's who? Honorable Mashish.
Yes.
you, Chairperson. I think my question has been taken, but even though I'll just come up with other questions. On that one of the recoveries, mine is only just to find out about the deadline. And then, secondly, I'll just want to know, get the clarity on the walkthrough. I was not clear how does it mean. And then, on that one of the Honorable Dankudi was talking about the files that was not recovered, the information. Do you also have the deadline on it? And lastly, I would be happy if we get a breakdown of the provinces, because it's just that the figure. We don't have the breakdown of the provinces so that we can see. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Mama Jole.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I also think that one's concerns have been covered by the previous speakers. But on the question of the whistleblowers and the informants, it seems to me the department should find a way, you know, of encouraging the people to report. But to simply say the information was vague and then thrown it away, to me it seems as if, you know, we are not getting into depth of the question. Well, obviously, people will be scared to give their names and so on, because we all know what happens to people who are whistleblowers sometimes. But still, for me, if, for instance, the location or the name of the project has been given, it should be possible for the province where this project is located. It should be possible for the municipality where the project is located to be able to know which project is really implied by the informant. I don't believe that people would just say things to the department which don't really exist. We all know there has been a lot of corruption in the area of housing, with the contractors, with the officials, and so on and so forth, the very municipalities themselves. So I think that we should find a way of encouraging people, find a way of making it possible, you know, for us to be able to identify as many of these projects as is possible. Because in that way, we'll be helping the people on the ground, people who are supposed to qualify for housing and who do not receive this housing. It frustrates them a great deal, the people on the ground. I remember one time, who was doing some work in one of the townships here in Cape Town. And we got to an area where there are RDP houses. And the people there were saying they have no accommodation. So we were saying to them, but look, there are so many RDP houses here. How does it happen? And of course, they told us about how houses were sold. At the time, they were being sold for 500 grand, so cheap. And they told us how, for instance, rather foreigners were accommodated in those houses rather than the people who really belong to those areas. So I'm just trying to say, you see, if they are whistleblowers, let's encourage them. They are the people who are going to help us identify quite a lot of them because of the people. Because there is slide 18 here. I would like to refer to that slide. Slide 18 gives us some of the improvements that have been made by the department according to the slide. But to me, it remains very, very vague. Too general. We would really like to know the actual, more detailed achievement. Because it's easy, you know, to read this and say, oh, a lot of improvements have been done. But without actually knowing what improvements they are. Which also then leads me to this point that has been raised here, Chairperson, about being specific about provinces. Because you see, if members of parliament are to do their oversight work in their own areas, they need to know, you know, how much their provinces have been affected. I keep asking myself the question, for instance, I wonder what the situation is with the Eastern Cape. I wonder what the situation is with my locality, the local municipality, where they are actually housing a process, human settlement process in the area. And one knows very well that a lot of unwanted activities have happened there. I do not understand what is meant by a number of contractors using one VAT number. Can the presenter please just unpack that one? What advantage, how does it happen? And what advantage does it give those people? I'm trying to find out in what way, you know, it may be illegal, but in what way? If you could just unpack that for me, I'll be happy. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Honorable.
Thank you, Chair. We have been covered in some areas. The other day I was talking about organized syndicates with municipal officials and people that live for as long as 20 years are hopped with signing memorandums, etc. Now gives me a clear picture, listening to the presentation, how these organized syndicates, some of them are also municipal officials, entering into a deal to evict innocent people and in the next few hours sell the very same home. These are all the things that are coming to light now. But Chairperson, you know, when you hear about attorneys stuck off the road, stuck off the conveyances road, you hear about government officials, municipal officials, contractors and engineers, all involved in this kind of corruption, I empathize with the department. You have a mammoth task. But I think we must commend for your positiveness, for getting yourself organized and dealing with the problems at hand. Wish you luck. I honestly think, Comrade Chair, that if all the corrupt officials and people open a political party, they don't have to worry for votes. I'm concerned about one. The presenter indicated that 40 million will be received in 60 months. In line with what Honorable Steyn had indicated, why should we give them the cake and let them eat it? That's unacceptable. If we are not contravening the Labor Relations Act in any which way that will place us in financial distress, then we must pursue. And I said that previously, the perpetrators must be charged criminally. The presenter indicated that she had collected 11 million, but only 5 million was paid to the department. Maybe if you could elaborate. I also want to find out, Chair, that I might be subjected to correction, but we're speaking so much about substandard quality of homes and all these kind of things. Homes are being currently demolished in KwaZulu-Natal as well. Are the NHBRC involved in any sort of corruption? Are they being investigated for any level of mismanagement? The other one was very important, that what Stain had raised, Honorable Stain, is about the movement of corrupt people that register different companies to acquire tenders. That must be looked at seriously. Also raised by Mr. Stain, unacceptable. The disciplinary process, we must remember that it perhaps maybe you have three officials in a department that awarded subsidies to over 2,000 people. Two or three people are responsible to create 2,000 corrupt cases. We must deal with the core of the problem. It's a sad day when you hear councillors are also involved. Mm-hmm. They must be removed. That's where the disciplinary process comes through with the relevant political parties. And they must, how can you have a public representative representing a constituency when they themselves are corrupt? It's a sad day for our democracy. I know, Chair, I raised that previously and you cautioned me. But I'm not saying this in a very bad way. I'm saying it in a very inspiring way. We have to clean up. We have to deal with the people who create these problems for us. Yes, Chair, the last one. The acknowledgement of debts that you're referring to, that you have signed 1,600. What value will this acknowledgement of debt have when you're dealing with corrupt people? They will sign the debt now, and a few months later, they might sequestrate themselves. Then you are left with a major problem. I think the right way is to immediately prosecute. What you say to, I just can't find the word, but immediately freeze the assets. And in that way you can get back some sort of the money that you might lose. So I'm going to leave it for there now. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson, but I don't want to talk for the sake of doing it. But, yeah.
Honorable Stollett.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, Chair, we have to thank you and the DG for this information, because it will help us as a portfolio committee. Chair, on page 22, where they implicate councillors, sometimes it can help us to know which areas are being implicated and the provinces, because we cannot just say Gauteng. The Gauteng is very vast, it's very big. We have to know which areas. And Chair, on page 24, where the department says that the SIU says they committed to work through in 9 provinces, but bullet three says only 3 provinces which have provided the report. We must know those provinces, because if others don't comply, we have to know those provinces. And Chair, I have an information, I don't know or I'm wrong, or that one of the mayor at KwaZulu-Natal have bought the materials to build the clinic. But he built those. He used those materials to build his house. He built the house by the material that he bought it for the clinic. And Chair, on page 34, when they are talking about disciplinary files, which is about 1,100, and that they hand it over to premiers. So we have to find the report. What is happening? Have they have the premiers complied with the sanction that they have been given to them? And page 36, they talk about 11 million which have been already collected from ICU, but they handed over to, they paid over to 5 million to the department. What happened to other 6 million? Thank you.
No, Chair, thank you very much. I just guess that members don't have their own informant. And I think it would be very bad for members of parliament to have their own informant. I just guess that members will avoid that. No. I think otherwise there are security agencies where all these informants are. And I think saying that it's not informant, I think it would be a third one. Now, Chair, I think the point that we do really appreciate the effort by the department to uproot corruption. I think we should appreciate that. I think it's very important because the department is very big. But also the department that is doing tangible things on the ground, and naturally there will be a lot of other people who are doing a lot of things, contractors and all other people. And I do think that the department should be putting in place a real system to fight against it. It's just I'm not sure in terms of the almost 2 million houses that have been delivered since 1994, what is the percentage of the problem? Because sometimes it's important just to know the percentage of the problem. Sometimes 1% can be blown out of proportion. And then you almost take this every human being, but really it's 1% that is causing a problem, and which I think that anyway we are dealing with them. And I think to me, the point that Director General, the President, has been complaining about, even before he was the President, is the time it takes just to discipline a simple worker in government. That's a simple worker in government. And it takes a lot of time. And I'm not sure whether the Director General, the department itself, is addressing this problem. Because also I find it very encouraging this side that some of the workers who were involved in this syndicate, you are taking almost a kind of view to them. They must repay department over 16 months. 60 months. And in fact, we are making it easy for them, despite the fact that they were engaged in a criminal activity. But we are careful, of course, that they are earning sometimes not a lot of money. Therefore, they must pay 200 rand a month. But we are making it easy for them. In fact, we are almost encouraging them to do what I think is wrong, because even 1 cent is wrong. Even if you defraud the department, 2 cents is wrong. And then, therefore, there should be some form of punishment, really. We shouldn't be so kind in such a way that the honorable person comes in there, does all the thing, and then he knows very well that I can negotiate with the department for 70 months just to repay 200 rand a month. At the same time, the person, they tend to be involved, because once they involve one, the propensity for them to involve in many other activities is very high. Generally, it's very high. To me, I think it's a bigger problem. And then, of course, I think there are labor laws that must be respected, all that, but I think we must really deal with this issue. I think it shouldn't be almost like an appreciation, really, for people who are engaged in these corrupt activities, because I think it's a problem. I do agree, Chair, that in terms of the elected leadership general, I think we should really deal with them a little bit harshly. It's correct. And it's just the point that some of the money will be recovered, some of the money won't be recovered. And then I guess because of liquidation, some companies, they come involved, they got involved, they built very poor quality houses. After that, 2 months down the line, they liquidate themselves. Therefore, can't really get the money back. But those individuals are busy driving beautiful cars all over South Africa. And then I'm not sure why we can't really go for them completely. I'm just saying, of course, doing that within the law, I'm not advocating anything outside the law, doing that within the law. And surely these are lawmakers, really. If the law that doesn't assist us to do, they will change. And they're just case, because not the one that you're talking about, to change, to ensure that we deal with these issues, because I think it's a bigger problem, really. And also what worries me is that many companies, one company is almost having subsidiaries, but they use one part number. Surely, Department of School should have been picked up this thing before even attended as awarded to a person. Because it's very easy to pick up all some of these things. I just think that the collision between those who are in departments and some syndicate outside department is much more stronger than we think. Unless it is crushed completely, I think we're going to find it very difficult to deal with some of these issues. Also, there are bodies really supposed to protect us against corruption. But it seems they're not really working in a manner that assists us to trace this thing earlier on. Because really building poor quality houses, I think the minister was saying that we'll spend about 2 billion rand, if I'm correct. And it's almost a wasted resources, generally. It's a lot of money. It's almost tantamount to corruption, generally. People who believe in it, they didn't steal money. But the fact that they built the poor quality houses that we are demolishing now at a very high cost, I think to me is a bigger problem that we have to deal with it. And I hope that the Director General will speed up some of these matters, because there should be some way. Even, I think, provinces themselves are able to act on this matter, and then quicker. Because I do think that, of course, we need a very professional public servant, very professional one, who are not engaged in all these other activities, because I think they are very serious ones. But I just hope that the provinces also are cooperating very well, and that you, when you call upon them to assist you to speed up some of the disciplinary issues, even the investigation. They work very well with your department. And then I think it's appreciated, really, that we are trying to do something on this matter. It's just we must really just ensure that we tighten the processes and systems in government to deal with this matter of corruption. And then unless we do that, I don't think we'll be able to defeat it very soon. And then it can cost us a lot of money, and also it affects a lot of the poor people anyway. I think it's important, sir, that we should, with the Director General and the team, just tighten up some of these issues. It shouldn't happen, because it's very easy. Like we've been talking about these issues of corruption in 1997, but 2009, and we still talk about the same thing. It seems we don't come to a cutoff, really, where it's very difficult for individuals even to attempt to get involved in corrupt activities. And then that would be my view, Chair, that I think we should tighten up our systems. All these organs that we have set up as government are supposed to deal with this matter. I think they should deal with this issue, and then to assist us to implement some of the decisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, just 4 questions which link up with some of the others, and I won't need another.
Okay. Just in terms of what I'd like to know, in terms of the money that's being recovered, does it go to Treasury? Or can it be ring-fenced? The DG mentioned the problem with getting funds for the SIU. Now, if we don't have the funds for the SIU to do their work, then we're going to be failing. So I'd like to know what happens with the money that's recovered. And is there a possibility it can be ring-fenced to go back to the SIU to continue to obviously get more money? Then just the last thing, and it links on with the question or the statements made by Richard, the acknowledgement of debt, and I think I've asked this before. If I'm not mistaken, the reply was that they sign an acknowledgement of debt for the value of the subsidy to repay that. Now, in a way, if that is what is being done, then they are actually being rewarded for being criminal, because it's not just the subsidy amount. It's the land value, it's the infrastructure. So they may have gotten a subsidy of 60,000 rand, which they have to pay back, but they end up getting a house worth 120,000 rand or more. So if that is the case, it needs to be revised. They need to pay back not the subsidy amount, but the full value of what that property is worth, and interest as well over the next 5 years, which again I believe is not the case at the moment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. I just want to check how do you define the unlawful beneficiary when you get to this case? I just want to get an indication. Who would we regard as an
unlawful beneficiary. And the other issue is around the gaps in the policies or the system. I just want to check if, I think the members have raised this, is this the only Section 4 of the Housing Act? But I think, what do you think about the Section 10 of the Housing Act? It does not, does it not have any implications on the on these issues? And I think on the issue of the officials, I don't know, PG, how are you going to manage this? Because you we were busy requesting the department to deal with the issue of the beneficiary management policy. And, you know, we were in Gauteng, but it's not Gauteng only. But you'll find that when the officials are presenting this beneficiary policy, they feel it. The officials only that have to manage this. No political political leadership is going to be involved. But as the Honorable Bula has said, I have cautioned him. I have said, and I still maintain it. Political or elected leadership, they have to lead. They have to give a direction. And the officials should comply. That is it. But I think because we are having this challenge now with us, of which I think I would suggest that we have got so many code of conduct that are there. But I think in the human settlement fraternity, we need to have another code of conduct for these people. And the communities are the ones that I think they can also play better oversight to this. But sometimes they get corrupt themselves. Because, you know, corruption in Doje, people would like to say cancer. But I think you need to work this thoroughly. But at least how can we ensure that we close this gap? I think there has to be a code of conduct. If you are you serve in a committee of human settlements delivered in your municipality, you have to sign another code of conduct. I don't know, but I just leave it to yourself. But really, it's a serious challenge. Over to you, Gigi.
Thank you, Madam Chair and honorable members for questions and comments. This is not a very easy matter, members and the chair. It's a very challenging matter. I appreciate that there is an appreciation of the effort that is being made to deal with the matter. It's not an easy one. In some instances, having engaged with SIU, it gets very complicated because of the people that get involved, particularly from a syndicate perspective. That's why some of the issues, we can't even put them in the content of our presentation. If we were to do that, you would have asked 100 questions than the ones we have asked. It's very complex. It's very sensitive, it's very involving, and it's very life-threatening. When I'm saying life-threatening, I mean what I'm saying. To be precise, some people have lost their lives in this particular process. There is that information. There's records to that effect. So it's not as simple as maybe we are painting it. I think it's important for me to comment that. It's a very complicated matter. It's a very life-threatening matter. But we cannot fold our arms and do nothing about it. we have a duty to do. I felt I should make that comment. And I've said earlier on that the information that we give to you is very generic in nature. It doesn't give you a much more broader perspective about other complications. But it gives you a picture. When we mention people who are involved, officials, leadership, you get a sense of the complexity of how it becomes difficult to deal with these issues. I know that colleagues have also asked information about different provinces and the breakdown. That information can be presented. The SIU has done that visitation throughout. But you also find that SIU struggles in other instances to get information because the very same people who must provide that information are also implicated. So it's very complex. It's not a very simplistic matter for them to deal with. Honorable Stein, I must protect my minister. I will, not because I have to, by virtue of my responsibility as a DG, but where I must do it, for correct reasons, I must do that. Your matter has received our attention, and we have communicated to you how we are dealing with the matter. Again, members, please bear with us. There's information I can't share with you. Once you've raised the matter, you've raised issues, ours is to take it where it belongs, because it doesn't belong to us. We don't have the capacity to investigate. The minister cannot investigate, cannot arrest, cannot fire any person. There are processes. Why I'm saying I'm protecting him in this particular instance is because we have indicated to you that the matter of NHBRC has been referred to SIU, and he was on media this week himself. He made a specific comment to that effect, and he has made that comment to yourself as well, that that matter is not a matter for us to do anything. He's the minister. There is a board in charge of NHBRC with an oversight responsibility. If whistleblowers bring information, or your informants, as we have referred to as, bring information to you, you bring it to us, we take it to SIU. That's the best we can do, Madam Chair. There is nothing beyond that that we can do. We cannot fire the CEO. We cannot fire the chairperson. We cannot fire any member of the board until the SIU will do its investigation and come back and say, Mr. Minister, because we have a responsibility over this particular board and institution, our findings are suggesting 1, 2, 3. Therefore, can you act in this manner? That's the only way the minister can act. I think that's very important, because we don't want to be seen to be not acting, and we don't want to act without ground. It's very dangerous. And for your information, the AG report says contrary as we speak, because they've given us an AG report on a number of areas that we've taken to AG, we have taken to SIU, AG has responded. And in contrary, some of the allegations are found to be not necessarily true. And that's AG now. So I'm trying to say we therefore cannot subject a political principal to a position where he must make a particular decision that could be misleading and act on those particular grounds. It's a very dangerous situation. So all that we are doing, the fact that our ministry has taken a decision to appoint SIU and budget money to do investigation is a step towards the right direction. We are saying we don't have the capacity, therefore SIU, because it doesn't have resources in terms of finance, we budget for that. For this current financial year, we are budgeting 20 million rand just to do the work that we are doing with SIU. So for me, it's a commitment that the department has made and it continues to make. So each time we receive information, we pass it to SIU, this is what we have. It's then their responsibility to put a methodology of investigating, checking whistleblowers. It's another very complicated matter, as Kumu has indicated. Some whistleblowers, they don't want to show their face for obvious reasons. It's a life-threatening situation. They don't want to show their faces, but they give information that gives you a lead. The investigator must take that information. Those who assure their faces, it makes life easier. Last week I met with one guy, for your information, who came from Northwest, who was prepared to show his face. One amongst 10 who will do that, who's saying, I'm prepared to give evidence, I'm prepared to show the face, I'm here. Whoever wants to interrogate me, I'm available, even if it means that I can be killed tomorrow. Few of those will be in existence in this particular. It's a very difficult situation. You'll find, therefore, that whistleblowers don't necessarily want to show up and give their names where they stay for obvious reasons. Some people, even their lives, get threatening when they are under witness program protection. When protection has been provided, they still get threatened, and some do get killed under witness program protection. I'm trying to reflect how serious the matter is. It's not an easy matter. And that sends a very negative message, because those who want to come forward, they then get afraid to do so. So I wanted to make that point, because I wouldn't like to be seen to be not doing that, and also to confirm that the matter for NHBRC, Honorable Bula, and Honorable Stay, has been referred to SIU. All the information we have received and allegations have been formally submitted to SIU, and the minister has pronounced on it in Parliament, has pronounced it in his media briefing this week. He has made a specific pronouncement on that particular matter. I will then ask Ekomo to... I think some of the comments, we must take them. I think one very fundamental comment is not to condone these activities through our responses. I think that is very important. Whatever mechanisms we put in place should not be seen to be condoning or treating these matters in a very light manner. I think it's a matter which we can also talk to FIU, because they are involved with mechanisms, and in doing so, they always check the legal issues on how to handle it. The issue of employees and disciplinary processes. Files have been developed by SIU. Files have been handed over to us. There are matters that require disciplinary action, which different departments and municipalities must act on based on those files. Those are not matters of criminal nature. They require us as a department to do that and provide guidance and use the mechanism that we have. So, and you are quite right, Honorable Mtangana, that we have our own mechanisms in place to deal with those processes. So we don't need a special act to be in place to deal with that. To discipline employees, we have a process, and we do that. That is why some officials have been arrested, and I take the point, as I've said, of saying you can't therefore ask them to repay the man over 60 months. It's like you're giving them a soft loan to say, go be involved in a criminal activity, but at your own pace, at your own time, we give you 60 months to repay the money. We take that point, and I'm sure that the FIU, as per their advice on those issues, they will be able to understand our concern that by so doing, we are actually promoting what we are trying. So that it's a self-defeating strategy in a way. But where we apply our own internal disciplinary processes, we do that, and we are going to advise those provinces, those municipalities where specific officials have been identified and files are with us, as they hand over to us, to say, on the following individual officials, please act and act decisively. If there's no capacity, there's always a mechanism to get external service providers to assist with that, and we'll encourage them to do that. So we are dealing with that. And where there's a clear criminal case, we don't even have to go through a disciplinary process. People get arrested, people go to court, we don't even get involved. They get charged, people have been sentenced, some of them have received fines. So that process we don't deal with. SIU continues with the process. Where we get involved is where the matter requires an internal disciplinary process. But where there's a clear criminal case, people get arrested, they don't even tell us. We don't even want to know. Just go and arrest Neville, put him in jail, charge him after they've done their investigation. We don't even get involved. We don't even recommend what to do. Once it's a clear-cut criminal case, they do their work. And as the report has indicated, there are specific numbers of cases where people have been arrested, have been sent to jail, and others are pending as well. again, we can't be specific at times to protect the investigation because it's continuing. It's going to be continuing. At times, SIU don't want to do whistleblowing to their own investigation by saying in this area we're targeting 40 councillors or 10 councillors, because by so doing, people will destroy information, as you are saying. So the information, the way again gets delivered, Madam Chair, you'll find that it's very skewed, and I'll ask members to understand that. At times it's skewed deliberately, because you are protecting other processes of investigation that are taking place. Some information you don't even give to us, because anybody can be, they know that Kum is dealing with this thing. They know I'm dealing with it. Anybody can be a victim. So at times they prefer not to tell us some information to protect their investigation through not giving us information as they investigate. They use their own methodologies. They use their own intelligence. So what they give us is what they know. It protects the processes of investigation. That's why the matter at times gets too sensitive, and at times we don't get to the bolts and nuts of it where we can give all the information as they want. I will now hand over to my colleagues. Neville, I think you want to say something on the questions I've raised, and I'm sure that Kumu will also do likewise. Neville?
Thanks, Chair. Just to follow up on the DG, Chair, you raised the issue about who's not authorized. I mean, any person who's not legally entitled and authorized to receive the benefit of a state subsidy is guilty of either fraud, corruption, or in instances, death. So if you don't meet those five criteria, any one of those criteria, because in reality you've got to be able to meet all five of them. So any person who is not legally entitled to receive that benefit. Jay, in relation to...
Just a moment. Because you found that I bought the house from Honorable Fickland. So how would you say I'm not legally... Because I bought it, I follow all the processes through deeds and all those things. Now you find me in that house. How would you say now I'm not legally, unless you have investigated that?
Chair, I mean, if Member Figlin in the first instance lawfully and legally received the house and the benefit, the house gets transferred to him, that's fine. If he then sells that house to you, following all the procedures, then you're legally entitled to receive that. The point of Section 10, and we raised this previously, one of the biggest problems in relation to the preemptive right is the sales are taken informally. You know, so some one of the flaws in the process is specifically it relates to sale. So rent, in many respects, is a grey area. You know, so someone might not be legally, I mean, might not be transgressing legally when they rent the house, because and that's one of the problems that we've indicated that sometimes, because municipality and provinces are unable to manage that process, because if people want to sell, they've got to come back, they've got to get permission. That's one of the. In relation to the disciplinary processes as the DG, there have been provinces that have taken disciplinary processes, and that's been there. I think what we must also be careful that it's the subsidies. Or where there's been unlawful and government employees claiming, it's not only housing officials, it's across the board. So that's it. Chair, you raised the issue about the issue of councillors and elected representatives' responsibilities. They have a very important responsibility. They in fact chair the steering committees, the project steering committees. And those project steering committees, if you look at the terms of reference in the code and together with everything, they must receive reports of the number of projects, who the beneficiaries are, all those kind of things. So if those project steering committees are not happening at the provincial and local authority level, and the councillors are in many respects supposed to chair those project steering committees. They're entitled to. There are variations of it. I mean, one of the ward committees, in many respects, sometimes substitute the steering committee. So your ward committees, but it depends on what the local dynamics and what the provincial and local policies are. But I think we need to reiterate that there's nothing in the code or the subsidy program that prohibits oversight and monitoring by elected representatives. There have been instances where even members of parliament have formed part of steering committees. Provincial legislation, if you stay in a ward, you can get elected or managed, but your local councillors do. If there are instances of that where councillors or elected representatives are, then we'd be interested to know where that happens, and we can write to the provinces through the DG's office and raise it. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Obviously, I will not deal with the issues that my supervisors have dealt with. The issue that was raised about the missing files that have not been given to the SIU. This matter is currently being followed up through the Joint Steering Committee meetings that take place on a monthly basis. The provinces, on a monthly basis, give reports on these files, and some of the provinces, and I specifically remember Northwest, they have indicated also that they can't find the files. They've even asked the HOD to get the files to be written off or something like that. In I think Western Cape, I think they had damages, so they all have reasons for their files. But then there's one province like your Free State that are saying because the filing system is so poor, they're currently looking for the files, and as and when they find the files, they will refer them. But the problem with that issue is that it takes too long for those files to come through. But there are various reasons, and I think maybe that's information that can be provided. But basically, apart from the natural disaster, that the flood issue, the basic reason is just poor filing systems. And as a result, through the department, we have a national forum on records management where we are providing capacity even to the provinces on how to do their records management and that sort of thing. So some work has been done in that area. The hotline referrals, the ministerial hotline referrals, they only started operating, because the question was how many was it since 2007. It's a recent activity. I think the people started writing to the minister, I think last year. So this information is coming through. There's a lot of information that has been referred, but the process that the DG indicated about having to then determine whether these indicators are worth investigating, it takes a long time to actually prepare the information to ensure that, to determine whether it is to be investigated or not. So that is why the outcome seems a little bit low, meaning two cases that have been finalized. The matter around the recoveries of liquidated contractors, I think that's a matter that through the recommendations that the SIU is giving to the department as and when they come across these issues, because they also have a legal expertise there. They
they come and they meet with our legal department to see to actually consider some of the legal recommendations, the recommendations that they give to us. And this is a point that has come up and is currently being discussed on how to deal with it and what act to apply. The breakdown of the money per province, as the DG has indicated, that some of these people are, and they earn very, but according to the SIU, most of these people that have benefited unlawfully, they earn, see the cutoff for free houses, for the low income houses, around 3.5 salary income. Some of these people, they earn around 4.2. So basically, then the payment is little. It's very little, and that is what is causing the IOD signed. The value is high; it's going to be recovered over time. The amount collected is very little. I mean, on the issue that refers to the VAT number, I think it's part of the the reviews that we are doing, or investigations that we're doing to the procurement processes, where we're trying to determine how were these companies are appointed. That is where some of these issues have come through, and through working with SARS, we're trying to determine which of the companies really is the rightful owner of the VAT number, and also part of the recommendations and all system gaps will be or non-compliance will be identified. Who are the officials that were failed to identify this problem, and those will be dealt with when the procurement investigations are really finalized. What happened? We collected 11 million, and I've indicated the SIU collect because these people that benefited unlawfully are spread across the country. So they receive the money, and then they do the reconciliations. And I think it takes longer for them to finalize the reconciliations. And as and when they have finalized the reconciliations, and this has become, like, because before they didn't do the reconciliation until we asked them to break down their collections per province, so that we can determine how much per province are they receiving. So the reconciliations take longer, but then as and when they conclude a certain figure, they then transfer the amount to the department. And yes, the monies are going to the provinces, back to the provinces, because there was an AG matter that was raised about dealing with this, raising the debt and closing off the accounts. The account, the money came out of the province. It was defrauded, so the province is sitting with the. They have opened up the accounts for, let's say, like it's a T account where it's because the money has been defrauded and a beneficiary has been found to be at fault. It then becomes a debt. The beneficiary now owes the department money, specific province money. So the AG raised an issue around how are they dealing with those money to make sure that, because the money that was paid, there's not, the money has been stolen, how do they close the account? So that is what eventually the JC decision was made, that the money be paid back to, and this was done through the National Treasury as well, be paid back to the specific provinces so that they can close off the account for a specific beneficiary as and when they receive the payment. Does it make sense? I think the other issues the DG and the COO have dealt with, unless if I'm missing something, because some of the issues relate to the report that the members want back at a certain point on other issues that they have raised. And other issues are comments, unless you can open something.
I agree. Because how would you ensure now the follow up to those problems? Because it goes back to the very same people, most of them were indicated. I'm saying, but actually, I'm getting Zambu Ipolika. Never. Can you interpret it? Can they also be bang eye? Because seemingly, one step forward, one step back. I'm not sure about this. Mr. Steyn, what would you want to talk about now?
Just the question about the total amount of the, excuse me, the acknowledgement of debt. Is it only the subsidy or is it the value of the house? That's one question that hasn't been answered. And then, Chair, I'd appreciate a moment just to respond to the CG on the specific issue relating to... I just need to raise something more.
I think we must accept the explanation from the DG that the matter is being taken care of. And I don't think we can exceed more to that. But if you feel that there's something, we can handle that. Even I can be part of it as the chairperson of the portfolio committee. Let's talk about it between the chairperson and the DG after this meeting so that you are satisfied. But let's not discuss it, this matter, because we all, and I think you reported that to the chairperson of the portfolio committee. And I also took it to the DG so that to say they must attend to this matter. We are taking it seriously as the portfolio committee because we are the people who are doing the job on the ground. So I'm saying let's appreciate the report from the DG. And then if you are not satisfied about something, let's deal with it. Trust me, as the chairperson of the portfolio committee, and I know you trust me, Mr. Steyn. I know you trust me. Thank you.
I want to clarify
something on the preemptive right. Section 10 sales. If a beneficiary sells his property and he got that benefit or the subsidy after 1st of February 2002, within the 8-year period, currently the restriction period in the law, and the transaction goes through the deeds office and is registered in the buyer's name, that still remains an illegal transaction. We have obtained a legal opinion from the senior state law advisors and a panel of advocates indicated that notwithstanding what happened in the deeds office, the provisions of the law remains. And in those cases, the MEC may then go and claim back, transfer of the property back into the MEC or the province's name and reallocate it to a qualifying beneficiary.
I fully support the law. But what about the department or government? Because I think what mechanism would the state has made to ensure that these beneficiaries, because these beneficiaries that are giving out these houses, they are not empowered or the capacity is not built to these people. Not all of them are informed about this preemptive clause. So, what role has been played by the municipality under the leadership of the department? Because now you are shifting the blame to the beneficiaries. But I think it has to start somewhere, DG. I fully agree with the legislation. But at some stage, we, the state, we are not enforcing. We are not trying to enforce this legislation that we have or the policies that we have. We are not enforcing them. So we just leave them to those people, and then at the end of the day, we punish people for not playing our role. Because we're in the DG's office in Free State. They confirm that they have never received any transactions that relates to Section 10A or 10B. We have been to Gauteng. We received the same report. That's why we asked you, what are you doing to ensure, what mechanisms did you put in place by the time you passed, by the time the legislation was passed? There were no mechanisms in place. They were just left there. And people are doing their own thing. And then now you are saying we're going to punish people. I'm not saying it's right, but we have to balance the issues. Thank you. I think that comes to the end of this discussion if there's nothing to add from the department. Do we have something to say?
No, I just wanted to respond to the issue about the subsidy. Is the recovery, is the subsidy plus the 15% interest. It's not the total value of the house. So we take the point about what you made, and I think that it is also.
I think, Titi, we thank you very much for this information. It was very, very important for the portfolio committee, and we appreciate the work that has been done by the department in relation to this. And we hope that this is not the last interaction. And you bear in mind that the members... No. The meeting is not over. We still have a second item. You bear in mind that the members raised concerns that this information was presented before. So next time when you come and present, you must be, there must be, there to be a way forward now in your information. There has to be new information. Let's get to the next item, the voucher scheme program. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Comfort break for five minutes.
I'm going to go to the next one.
I don't know.
Sabe como uma. Hey, I go my dear Kuna. I go my dear Kuna. Kuna. Ah, muito obrigado. Eu tenho nada muito bom. Muito bem. Ai. Vou dizer que eu passei direito.
providing non-secured lending in these areas were cited as opportunities for us to contract also the private sector to assist us in this regard. In regard to the land rights, the difference between this individual subsidy program and a normal one, of course, is the fact that the people in these areas live on communally owned land, informal land rights. The rules normally that apply in terms of the rural program also applies to this program, and that is if you claim land rights, it must be uncontested. It must be confirmed and you must prove your land rights. It's normally state-owned land, but in KwaZulu-Natal it's also in Nkunyama Trust land, of course, and therefore the minister assigned to manage the state assets must give approval for developments on these land, of course. If you are able to access an individual subsidy within a formalized township, this program will not assist you. It's only then for people with informal land rights. Very quickly, how it will work. First and foremost, the Rural Housing Loan Fund would be required to negotiate on an annual basis over the MTF period and onwards a budget allocation with the MEC for it to enable it to launch the program and to then entertain subsidy administration. So the once agreement has been reached, official agreement will be signed between the MEC and the Rural Housing Loan Fund, and it will then on a cash flow basis receive money from the MEC to enable it to fulfill its functions. Ralph will evaluate all the applications that gathered at the rural local level by the rural lenders, and then we will forward the applications for official approval because the decision-making authority remains with the MEC of an individual subsidy. Once approved, then the program will be launched, the vouchers will be issued, and the necessary structure will kick in place to allow these people then to claim the materials on a phased approach. In return for the services delivered, we've agreed with Ralph from the outset that they will receive a total amount of 5% of the individual subsidy that applies to this program. Now, the individual subsidy currently available to the individuals in these areas would be 65,700. Which is actually the basic cost of the top structure plus the site services cost. And there you can see 5% of that amount equates to 2,285 rand per individual subsidy beneficiary. Ralph will then also accredit the subsidy intermediaries on an approved basis, and they will then be able to participate in the scheme. Ralph has also been empowered to pay the approved subsidy money to the subsidy intermediaries on a cash flow basis to enable them to pay material suppliers. You would, however, see later on in the submission that based on the identified risks, Rolf has decided not to pursue that route, but to remain the prime payer of the money directly to the material suppliers because of the inherent risk of leakage between Rolf and these accredited local non-secured retail lenders. However, if we can find the appropriate environment, the intermediaries will then pay the material suppliers upon certification that material was delivered. And also service providers, you must know that certain aspects of a house cannot be done by the individual. These needs require professional services like the plumbing and electricity, if electricity is available. And for that purpose, we will then also pay certain service providers. Yes, the material suppliers in the rural areas will be allowed to apply for accreditation to participate in advanced material within the program. And for that purpose, a complete material specification list has been drawn up, and it's part and parcel of the approved program. Just in brief, to continue, the role of the subsidy administration would be Rolf. They will primarily be responsible for advocating the scheme, to train the beneficiaries, to assist with applications for subsidies, administer the vouchers, to make payments to material suppliers and service providers. And as I've indicated, this may be outsourced, but it remains part of the 5% fee. So every person or institution appointed down the road
must still be financed from the 5% for additional money that Ralph may found their hands on. As I've indicated, the MEC remains the decision-making authority, and the beneficiary may then draw pre-approved materials on a structured phase process. This means that you must complete phase one before you will be able to draw phase two material. So you first dug your trenches, you do your foundations and your plinth, and then you can apply to your material supplier through Ralph for the issuing of your next phase, which will be then your wall materials and so forth. That is to prevent further leakage. But we will come to the rest a little bit later on. The beneficiary may also, from his own resources, employ people to assist him with the construction, local artisans, bricklayers, and so on. If there is any money within every phase available, a residual amount, after we've paid the material supplies, that money would be advanced to the beneficiary for payment of these informal service providers that they used. But this is one of the critical areas, is the verification of achievement for money, value for money. And we've advocated to Ralph that they should appoint service providers to certify material delivery, to certify quality workmanship, to certify whether a phase has been completed before the next phase materials are issued. Unfortunately, as indicated, all these service providers will have to be paid from the 5%. So this is a critical aspect of the success of this program. I've also alluded to the fact that we have completed the material list of a typical subsidy house, that the suppliers would be accredited. There's not any supplier. We want to check the stock. We want to make sure that SABS-approved materials are delivered to our beneficiaries. We have agreed that the standard house plan will be issued. It's not forced onto the people, but it will make it easier for them to get planning approval from the municipality. We don't also want to change the rural context, so what we are looking at is a more rural development or planned units, and that the NHBRC has already committed to assist us in that regard. We would like to advocate initial launch of the pilot phase, and you will see that we also want a pilot phase so that we can learn lessons before we add it all on a national basis, but that we do it in a phased approach, and we start off with new units before we transfer and allow the upgrading of existing units, which poses different problems. But it will. It is part of the equation of the program to do that as well. But initially, we would like to focus on new units. The municipality is still to approve all the plans. So if we can agree with the beneficiaries to use a standard plan, then obviously it will make it easier. We can get once-off approval by the municipality in a specific area, and everybody's plans can then be approved. The normal qualification criteria will apply, the subsidy qualification criteria. NHBRC registration of the and enrollment of the houses are not required because these are self-help builders, it's not contractors. And secondly, the units or the properties are not registered in the name of the beneficiaries. The norms and standards of the subsidy scheme apply as a guideline, but we've tried to accommodate variations to ensure that we maintain the rural context. As I've indicated, we would like to focus on new dwellings at first. What we still need to do, Madam Chair, is to finalize the voucher scheme, the appointment of a firm to produce the smart card for us, and the machinery at the local level against which you can swipe and then claim your materials. The standard house plans must still be finalized. The contractual documents between the various role players must still be developed. And also a framework for the accreditation of all the role players that will participate in the scheme. Now, Madam Chair, I think previously we have alluded to in the previous presentation of this program to the severe challenges that this program posed to us. And these are the main ones that we've identified. Possible funding misappropriation. I mean, a beneficiary may claim the first round, the first phase materials, and then sell it. We will then lose the first phase investment if that happens. And that's a possibility. there's a possibility that the unit will never be completed and that the Rural Housing Loan Fund would sit on their books with money outstanding, houses not completed, materials not delivered, and these lists pose specific challenges to us. Inferior workmanship is a major problem for us. I must say this is a huge concern. We have battled to address this issue within a people's housing process project to the effect that we're happy with it, and now we're embarking on individual subsidies, which will be much more difficult to control. There will be possible conflict between the parties. I mean, a material supplier will claim that they've delivered sand to a unit, and the beneficiary will say, I've never received it. How do you deal with that? How do you resolve that? The other problem is that in most of these areas, quite remote, the service providers are quite distant from the beneficiaries, and that poses specific problems to us. And we will have to try and address that as well. Not the retail, informal retail lenders are not always available in these areas. That also poses a problem, as our first interface between the beneficiary and the program would be your lender at that phase. And that may also have limiting the application of the program to a certain extent. Transporting of materials is also a big problem for us. Not so sure that the material suppliers will be able and willing to deliver in these areas where roads, in many cases, don't even exist, proper roads. So that may also be a limiting factor. Based on the identified risk, madam, we've asked Graf to look at the risk, and they have developed a comprehensive risk management mitigation program. In summary, what the risk mitigation actually entails is that they would pay directly. That would solve a lot of the problems of our perceived leakage. And secondly, to embark on a phased development approach and not nationally roll out the program at once, but to check whether the loopholes are, where enhancements to the program and the policy prescripts are required on a smaller scale by means of certain targeted areas that need still to be approved. And we will submit our proposals in that regard to the Minister, of course, before we roll out, so that the MECs are happy in terms of how we proceed. Now, the financial implications, I have indicated that we have agreed with Ralph on the 5%, but when the MINMEC decision of the approval of the program dawned on them, they then realized that the work involved in this as a subsidy administrator go beyond their imagination. They have obviously also access to the German donor funding, which is a basis of an agreement between the Department of Finance and this the German funder. But over and above access to that funding, they have indicated that they will require another 8 million rand for year one of the pilot phase, and over the MTF period of implementation, 25 million rand, over and above the fee of 5% of the subsidy. Now, you can imagine that ROF is a very small specialized institution. I think they've got 5 to 7 members currently there. They are faced with total restructuring at this moment in time to create the necessary capacity to engage with the MECs, to enroll the subsidies, to gather the subsidy application forms, negotiate with the material suppliers, to provide the necessary supervision. And therefore, this is what they say. If we are serious in regard to rolling out the program, this is the money that it would require to achieve this kind of development. Based on these findings and the indications by MINMEC, the fact that that RALF will have to restructure, MINMEC decided that based on the broader concept of rationalizing what is referred to as the Housing Finance Development Institution that we have currently, that we defer the implementation of the program until such time as that we have surety on what the development finance institution would be, what its capacity would be, and whether it will not be more suitable
to implement the program at the end of the day. And Ralph is part and parcel of this rethink of the current housing development finance revision. This is work in progress. My colleague from our housing institutions director indicated to me that we have appointed expertise to investigate and table proposals, so we are working towards the rationalization or the creation of a new housing development finance institution. But for the meantime, then, the program has been put on hold by Housing and MEC until such time as we have finality on that. Thank you very much, ma'am.
No, because this program, whenever we debate, but when it comes to the system, I'm not saying it wrong with this, but I think his strategy is then it must be an overall strategy, not bit by bit. Apart from the portfolio committee comment on these challenges, the challenges, imagine. Why I'm saying that? How is that? Transporting. One of my car of Dalla is a kid is in you. How was so cold? My daughter, I broke them with transport. A transporter is a donkey. Why are they like his daughter? Why is it going to be so difficult? My own government. Availability of suppliers. Sakan and don't tell my car. Sakan and that. The availability of subsidy administrators, can leave it. Availability of service providers. Sometimes we would see better off than is in the Zakua, Kavandavana is a service contractor. Abantu abasakhela izindlu emakhaya as long unobenofundiswa kakuhle xa beza bakhaya ezi zinto bathi izinto ezibhetele nditsho mna aba bapha emakhaya nani niyayazi ndikhulile emakhaya i-conflict between i-parties there has always been the conflict management mechanism that is not a huge challenge. Inferior workmen, I call on to find Lali. These little are called that are still corners on. I can't quit that. Possible incomplete dwellings. The other thing has a trade in Mali, conduct another thing has a trade with Asnama Fat or Vaka. He was Ufunikaya. On a dirty Ufunikaya. Funding, misappropriation, yes, but it's not so. I don't think my color is wrong. So, the company is not doing it. They are not there. Honorable member. Honorable Richard.
No, sir.
Honorable Stein. Honorable Lavute. Oh. Honorable Fickland. Honorable. Everybody. Mama. Honorable Pula. We still have some time.
I wanted just to raise that, I think it is a good attempt to address the problem of our rural area. And I guess that it would assist us, many of us who are from Ekuten, at least for the first time, will have some loan to build our own houses. I do think that I guess that Director General, your team has visited that account that are successful in rural development. Therefore, you have learned some experiences in that. and then it would be easy when to work it out in a manner that assists rural people also to develop. Firstly, I thought it's going to create also jobs for rural people. So there are a lot of builders in rural areas. But because they build one Lobo house, another one here, another Zulu house, many of the Zulus anyway, they don't build houses. That is their main problem. And therefore, they're not assisting us to develop local economy. And then I guess that it's important that the matter, because every corner of our country, one thing for sure, they are councillors, they are ward committees. Therefore, one way or another, there should be a management that is tighter in terms of, course, the Kumis here, if they see our man, I think they'll be arrested. And then, therefore, there's no problem about that. And then I do think, Chair, that what we should in really do in the Director General is the issue that, you know, you will postpone it until the Housing Development Finance Institution is concluded. Because I'm not sure how long it's going to take you anyway to conclude it, given the fact that our own view as a committee always that we are creating more and more of these institutions that need money themselves. Therefore, it's not something that is going to happen overnight. Bearing in mind that we have already taken a bold decision that rural areas must be assisted to develop too. Therefore, rural development becomes the central issue that is one of the most important areas for many of us. And therefore, any delay around housing, because some of the situation in rural areas is very dire situation. Therefore, they need intervention by government sooner than yesterday. Of course, there are people in rural areas who have built their own villas, very beautiful houses. And I guess that there are people who are suffering in rural areas that I don't think we should wait until we have the development of finance, because every corner, as far as I know, in South Africa, there's a councillor, there's a ward committee. But also those people, even if they are, many of them, very difficult to access, I agree, in terms of delivery. But generally, they go to shop, they buy food, they know exactly how to do that thing. Unless we are not involving them, the likelihood for us then to think that it is impossible is that we are not involved in that. Therefore, can have really bigger problem. And that, to me, given the fact that anyway, through migration, people are in rural areas even today in South Africa because of the structure of our economy. African women, broadly speaking, people are in rural areas right now, except old men really who have been taken out of Alexandria because they can't work. But generally, African women were experiencing this problem in rural areas. Therefore, to postpone really even by one day, I think we are causing more problems for them, given the fact that they carry more burden than any other women, generally. Therefore, in my view, it's important to start with the initiative. I appreciate the point that it's a pilot project somewhere. But my view really is that it's important that this is a pilot project to be done sooner, because you learn from that experience. To postpone it more than this, I think, would be a very difficult thing to do. And I accept that there would be risk, really. Anyway, there are risks in Alexandria development. I think the presidential project there, there are always risks everywhere where money is involved. But I do think that involving people themselves, you find some of the risks that are here are very mitigated. And because people themselves, anyway, once they're involved, because I think it is important at the physical level that people should be involved in building their own house. Because the same style, same design, every corner of South Africa doesn't exist. Every house, you know that, all of them, that they say. But people are very clever, so they know anyway where's their home. But I think it's very difficult, because I think it's a bigger problem. I think we must do that share. And in my view, and then from time to time, Director General, if there are real problems, bigger problems on corruption, non-delivery of material, I think the point that you are raising, but also people taking chances, they take chances everywhere. Many of us who are building our own parents' homes in rural areas, we know very well that some of these buildings can disappear. Is there a risk that the necessary to take in order for you to provide accommodation? I don't think we should have government structure running away from that responsibility. On the ground that there are risks, there are every risk that are correct, some of them. But one thing for sure that I think really we should do I think there will be other areas that are not at point that I think will identify a director general in some provinces, and then we start really working there. We may find anyway, not every family want their house in that area, but some of them are very, very beautiful. I thought, firstly, the approach director general would be said, who are the most vulnerable in his community? And therefore, you start with people who can't build their own houses in rural areas. Because some of them, they put very beautiful homes anyway, homes there, really. They would, in fact, if you build a house, that's why they have little houses that sometimes they build an area, they will put it somewhere they back. They use it as a crawl, really. Generally, a crawl and for chickens, and for goats. And, because people don't appreciate it, because they're not in part and parcel of designing it. And I guess that we should just ensure that our people generally are involved, councillors are involved, one way I'm not involved in terms of allocation, but there will be no allocation in those areas because it's individual subsidies. But really, Director General, you know very well, many of us who have been in rural areas one way or another, we know that even in rural areas, there are really many families who can't afford to build their own house. Therefore, it should be your first task. You have to elevate the problem of those women there, in my view, is the first criteria. And then there are families that I think they share families. I think they've built many rounds of hair. All of them are still right. Therefore, they can follow as time goes on. But I think it's important that we do that, generally. Because then we'll assist in the problem of elevating some of the issues. And people are able to fetch their building material. It really is not conducive for them to do so. But out of the roads, because it will take you many, many months anyway to have those roads to deliver material. I think we should use the existing system of delivery in rural areas for them to do what they have to do. And then in my view, really, I think we shouldn't postpone it because of the formation of the development structures there. I think it would take longer than necessary. And then in my view, then we should experiment it somewhere, just like the general. And also there are a lot of experiences I get on the ground that we have learned. And they can assist us really to address it. That would be really my appeal on this one. I never seen it working anywhere. I never visited India. But I know that Bula has been in India several times. It can assist us to deal with some of these issues. But really, in my view, we shouldn't really hesitate to support the program. And hopefully, Mr. Van der Vaart, then you are able to design systems and then procedures that can assist very easily some of the rural people.
Thank you, Chairperson. I endorse everything that Richard said, except one statement. And I think it was the very first one. He said he was grateful that he now has an opportunity to get a subsidy to build his rural house. Take note, CG, he doesn't qualify. And Chair, most of my other questions have been answered as the presentation went along. I want to specifically emphasize Richard's comment also that I'm concerned that we're putting, I think it's an innovative idea, and I'm concerned that we're looking, or Minmec has looked at putting it on hold, because there's no time frame on this housing development finance institution. And perhaps even there may have to be some form of legislation to make that come into being, and that can then take years. So I would endorse the fact that the department identifies a pilot project where perhaps they know there's a reasonable number of beneficiaries that qualify, and that we implement something like this, obviously not on the scale that you're thinking about, but because whatever happens in the future, whatever you learn from this will help the process forward, even if it goes via this other institute. The only other question I have, Chairperson, is obviously in terms of you made mention of a smart card at one point, and then you said Ralph would prefer to make the payments themselves, which I think would make the requirement of a smart card almost obsolete, because they're not going to swipe it then, because Ralph will. But as far as possible, particularly if it's just a pilot project, that we make use of existing infrastructure. If there's some sort of a bank or a money or something that's there already that we can utilize. But my main question is the money that Ralph wants up front, 8 million in the first year, if they should go ahead, and 25 million over the 3-year MTF period. Is that linked to a projected number of subsidies? And if so,
you know, what, I know you said 5% of the subsidy, but I'm concerned about this, that they want this money without really putting a plan together that it will service X number of subsidies. And in that case, I'm a bit concerned, because if money is given like that without any outcomes linked to it, then it tends to find ways of being used up. So that's my only concern, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to agree with my Chairperson and with there on the issue, on the challenges that are raised here. They are not there. Because I know for sure I'm from the rural area. There are lots of suppliers, and those suppliers are delivering the materials to the people. Then one other question, Chairperson, the question I have here is this thing of MEC approval. Is this process not going, is this approval by the MECs not going to delay the process? Because we know that MECs are always busy, they are always here and there. Is this not going to delay the process? And what criteria are they going to use to approve this this application? Then, on your verification, you mentioned that RALF may also appoint service providers to certify whatever. How sure are we that these people will not be corrupted? Because the departments have in the past appointed these inspectors, housing inspectors, but they were not doing their work according to their specifications. They were corrupted, and at the end of the day, the houses that we built for our people were a disgrace. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Chairman. I think I was getting sleepy now. And I allow all the ladies to speak, because this is their month and their freedom. Now, in my culture, everybody must speak, then the man must speak last. And then... Now, I just want to say, Chairperson, I'm mostly covered, but I just want to find out something, because this individual subsidy was done before, especially in Cape Town, where most of the houses were unfinished. There were vouchers that were given to people. Now, you can have a voucher. You first buy maybe 100 bricks, and then after that, you can make an appointment with somebody where you can say to him, okay, you want to finish your house? You can give me so much money. Here's a voucher, you can buy the stuff. But I'm happy that there will be somebody who will be doing oversight, like Ralph, who will carry on looking if the foundation is done and then give you the material. But the other question that I want to ask is the question of, in the rural areas, you can see there's people who try to build a big house where the person will say, I'll spend all my pension on this. But he's not working anymore, and he can be helped through the individual subsidy. Now, do we cater for people like that, where we can finish the house? Maybe, say, if my subsidy is 60,000, and then to finish my house, it will cost me about 45,000. So are we allowed to apply for that? Thank you, Chair.
I have to give you, because you have requested to leave at 12. So let me give you an opportunity.
No, thank you, Chair. I've been adequately covered, but I'm not going to respond to the India matter. But if I may, just to inform the Honorable Whip that India had created 350 middle class, and that is why the economy is flourishing. It's because of the knowledge industry. So what we need here is we need skills and knowledge. We appreciate that there are challenges, but ultimately people want homes in the rural area. People are now asking, what have they, some of them, laid down their lives for? once we have obtained our freedom, we still need to fight to get homes. And this is the sad part of our democracy. But I think what we need to do is evaluate the challenges and put responsibilities on various organizations. Mention has been made, Chair, about the local authority, municipality, monitoring the issue of plans, yet it has no legal binding over it, but just a normal oversight role. Now, if that could be done with the local authority, then I think it would be prudent for them to assist in the various challenges that we foresee that we're going to experience in the rural areas. But I want to quote one example, and I think it's important. I'm talking about a dense rural area which recently was hit by very, very bad floods. Some of these people are still living in containers. Therefore, I don't see the importance of suspending a particular program or policy whilst our people are living in destitute. What precautionary measures or what substitute measures have been put? Okay, we understand we've got this temporary housing where people from the rural areas are taken and just put into any area just because of the situation of being involved in floods. Now, if what amazes me, if temporary homes could be built to address these challenges of their rural homes being washed away, why not put all the relevant measures in place and build their homes in the rural area? Chairperson, there's just one more other point I wanted to raise, is the issue of the, I know what's the mandate of the HDA, but I also hear there's a lot of challenges that you have. Now, in some provinces, I do understand there's no HDA offices. Perhaps you could utilize some of their expertise, help, and assistance to overcome some of the challenges that you are quoting, that you have here.
The HDA?
Yes. Yeah. Housing Development Agency. Thank you, Chip.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like the presenter to help me understand what informal land rights are, because, you know, I'm asking myself a question as to when I'm in a communal land where an individual does not hold a title deed if a person qualifies. The other thing, as far as challenges are concerned, I'm from a rural area myself, you know, and back home, even if you don't have a car, you just go take a taxi to Cashbelt and you'll find vans and trucks waiting for you at a very reasonable price. So it should not be a problem. And to add to that, if you buy from your Cashbelt, I mean, if you buy for 3,000 and more, they offer, depending on where you stay, they offer free delivery. Yeah. On your subsidy administrators, the type of training they're going to give to beneficiaries, what type of a training are they going to give? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I think Chair, if it comes to this rural development, I have a lot of concerns. I think we cannot modify the rural development. We must take it as a rural development. I'm from rural areas. I know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me add to the question on land rights. You know, when you think of the rural areas, in some parts, I'm thinking in particular of some areas in the sky, for example, in the Transkei. You've got the village, land, but you also have people who own small pieces of land, small holdings. It's quite a good group of people. But you find that because that land is somewhat private, regarded as private, and government does not spend money on private land, understandable. But the problem is that the irony of it is that those people get left behind. They don't benefit from government programs. And one of those programs is housing itself. And yet, their condition, their economic condition, is exactly the same as those who are out there in the village. I think we should consider that and see where we can fit these people. They really get isolated. For example, we find that even when water, you know, is being brought to the village, they are not given that water. They are isolated. They don't get the water because it is said they are on private land. They must get their own water. In fact, I'm one of the victims when it comes to that. If I end the day, my house is here in the village. And it's not coming to me. I will have to pay for my own tax. Right now I can afford. But what about other people who cannot afford? I'm just quoting this, you know, because I can see even here when I talk about land rights, those people are going to continue to be isolated and they miss the government and process. Now, secondly, Chairperson, on the question of challenges, I know yourself and other members have said the challenge is not exist. But I wouldn't agree 100% that the challenge is not exist if they are put in this document. Maybe it's a question of areas not being exactly the same. The question of workmanship, poor workmanship. The question of possibly not having enough capacity in the area. So in my opinion, I would say, why don't we, having identified the area and noticed what capacity there is in that area, why don't we encourage, for instance, training first before we start the program for a particular area if we want to involve the local people as well? But of course, I know the training may not necessarily be the task of the Department of Human Settlements. Education also comes in here. The speakers also come in here. But then the planning could be coordinated by the department concerned, such that you know that in that particular area, for instance, we can encourage a group of people, a cooperative, for example, to start making bricks, but bricks of a particular standard as accepted, or accepted as acceptable to the department. So that at the end of it all, you have not only just put up houses there, but you have also transferred skills to the people in that particular area. That would be my proposal. It's a little bit more complicated, I'm aware, but I think if we take time over some of these things can actually work. Now, the question of the upgrading of the existing houses, it says that will come later. I think that is a question. If it's going to work out like that. Because really, some of the existing houses do need the attention of the department very seriously. And I think if that could also be part of it, it would be very helpful. Chairperson, this is not to say we don't appreciate what the government is trying to do. I think actually if attention can be given to the people in the rural areas, in the area of housing, this will help us a great deal. Because those people are just as poor as people, for instance, in the peri-urban areas.
And there has been this complaint over the years that the housing is for people in urban areas, but people in the rural areas, as much as they vote, you know, for the government and other political parties, they don't get they don't benefit from the government program. So I think it is a step in the correct direction. We really appreciate that. On the MEC question, having to negotiate with the MEC for the funding, I find it vague the way it is put here. But we know that government a budget, isn't it? And there is a time for the budget, both at national level and at provincial level, even at municipal level. So why don't we link this rather than saying we negotiate? Why don't we link it to the budgeting process, the budgeting system, the budgeting time for both national and provincial or even local government for that matter? You see, one of the reasons is because we know that monies get transferred in some cases to provinces, but provinces have their own priorities. But here is the National Department of Human Settlement. It's intending to carry out a particular program in a particular province. But if, for instance, there is a linkage about the budgeting between national and provincial and the aims of the national department to put up a project in a particular village, then the province should be obliged, in my opinion. The MPC should be obliged to budget for that. Not just a question of negotiation, but they should be obliged so that the national department can also carry out the program. After all, those funds would have come from the national department anyway. I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear. But my case is more formalized than, you know, something depending on negotiations, whether the MDC has to be or not. Thank you, sir.
Are you clear, ma'am? There you to put in a percentage of rural development, reallocation, yeah. But the problem, the implementation, and our provinces have been allowed to change a business plan, what is the business plan, as well as the talk allocation of a fund, of which we have been strict measures about that. And I feel very bad because I was just thinking, the majority of the MEPs are from the rural areas. But if they cannot take serious, because they are the ones who have taken this decision in the MIMEC, it means they are no longer having interest on the rural development, because one of the better is Dolomi. And you won't allow that situation to change. You are sending a strong message. Go back to them. Tell them that Parliament is not, the portfolio committee is not accepting them. They must try and reverse their decision and show that there has to be a pilot, or most of the members. There has to be a pilot project in the rural, because those provinces have got only three rural provinces. Evangelia, we are referring to people in the rural areas. Abadinga is in. Abadinga, the service deliver. It's only Eastern Cape, only Limpopo, only KZN, those are the most. Oh, Kumala, most rural. No, most rural. Nah, not the Cape, not rural. I'm referring to at least. You can have a pilot project. Really? No, we don't agree with you guys.
I think the comments that are being made, Madam Chair, are valid, and they also help to shape the perspective. I think it's a fact that rural development or rural communities, to a larger degree, have been ignored. I think the center of focus for development is mainly urban in our areas. I think maybe that is why also the ruling party, through its own manifesto, took a decision to say rural development should be also a core area of focus. So as a matter of directive, all departments in government should be putting rural development strategies. And part of our focus should be this particular area as human settlement. This could be the beginning of more things that we can do in rural development from a human settlement perspective. That includes bulk services that should come with this, not just for me, the picture should be bigger than what we're doing, but this could just be the beginning. As we debate, it has brought back to me the concept which we once shared upon the new dawn of our democracy of people-centered development. This is where people can tell you easily how you can do what they want in terms of their own environment, not what you think you can do for them. I think if it's more people-centered approaches adopted, as members were saying, a number of challenges we have referred to can be dealt with easily. We can turn that into more opportunities than challenges if we adopt a people-centered approach in every rural area, because they will know they've got their own institutional memory that you can tap into to say, if we want to do 1, 2, 3, you tell us how we can do it. They'll give you all the answers more easily than we can have challenges. So I think we'll refine it. And I think in this particular aspect of rural development, we should be more people-centered in our developmental thinking than to be more bureaucratic. That's the way we can achieve more if we adopt that approach of people-centered approach and consult different communities as we implement, as we pilot as well, Louis. I think that will help us, and I'm sure our team will be able to look in other innovative measures that we can put in place within the rural context through a people-centered approach by consulting the members. So I think your comments are valid, and we'll build on them as we pilot this project. Also, I think what we'll try to do with my team is to try and establish a process that could be quicker for implementation purposes. I was talking to COO as the matter is being raised, how soon can we implement this? And then he raised an issue of funding. I will deal with that issue and allow us to come back with a business plan. Louis will develop a business plan now for implementation and for the funding that is required. If we have challenges, we'll bring it to you. But we are trying to put a national program as well and identify funding from different provinces. This could be one program that we can identify for implementation. So I will look into the process, Madam Chair, and come back and say, we think from a departmental point of view, we can kickstart this program at this particular point, in this particular area, and these are the implications financially of what we'll be doing. Louis, I'm sure you'd like to respond to some of the questions raised.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, DG. I think the DG has summarized it quite nicely. Perhaps we could just allude to certain specific small issues that were raised. I think perhaps the challenges slide was a little bit misinterpreted. The challenges slide is just to indicate to you what are we faced with. But these are not scaring us out of the program. In fact, we've developed a strategy to mitigate most of them. But they remain there, and we will have to address them as we implement. The main problem is the institutional environment in which we need to launch this program. That's what's keeping us back. So I'm not going to address all the challenges questions. I think we agree that they are there, and we will have to address them and overcome them as we proceed. We agree, ma'am, that the approach must always be a people-centered approach. The problem with this program is it is individually based. The rural, individual rural program of the community program that addresses project link subsidies are more suited to get the community involved in solving their own problems. This is a program that augments that program to a certain extent to create for the individual that's not necessarily part of a community process access to the subsidy funding.
But their involvement is critical. They will have to build the houses. They will make the decision on the design. So the program in its core is in fact a people-driven process in any event. So we agree with the people's, and we agree that they have solutions. If you look at the challenges are national ones. In certain areas, most of them may not exist at all. All these materials will be delivered. There is a service provider available and so forth. But I'm giving you a national picture where instances will exist where it doesn't exist, where there will be some special methods and efforts to make it work. The madam that's on her birthday, I see she's 21, but she's got 15 years experience, I guess. I just want to say, ma'am, you said the challenges doesn't exist, and then you put another challenge on the table for me by saying my service providers in these areas could be corrupt. That is a real threat, and between us and Ralph, we must sit and work out perhaps a minimum requirement for a certifier. What does this person must look like? What attributes must he have, and what skills? And that is still work to be done. But I think what we normally do is I develop my policies in the Ethiopian environment. Everybody is honest, there's no corruption and so on. So I believe that we would find the right people to help us in this process. But it's a real concern. There may be individuals that cahoots with the individuals and falsely certify completion stages and material will be issued, and our losses may be on the increase. What we don't want is a rectification program for this program in a few years' time. That we cannot afford. The issue of people with existing houses, if they satisfy the qualification criteria, and that is what the MEC will measure, to answer that question as well, the MEC will evaluate a subsidy application against the qualification criteria and the land rights that the person has, and only that, and no other criteria. But the program will be available for people to complete their houses. That's no problem. What we're saying is we want first to launch it for new construction and see how it works, and then we will entertain on the later stage perhaps people to enhance their houses or renovate their houses. I'm not saying that it will necessarily delay that side of it. If it's possible, we could always launch that as well. But Ralph felt that in terms of the difficulties with the program, they first would like to focus on new build, and then later on, as we have the mechanisms in place, entertain also the completion, upgrading of existing. But those are all applicable. The problem is if you have a big house, we will only give you 65,000 rand for the house and the service. And so you will have to complete your big house with that money. We're not going to entertain a different subsidy because your house is bigger. I cannot comment on the Honourable Member's comments in regard to the flood damaged houses because I don't have specific project particulars in mind and I don't have access to it. Suffice to say that I feel that should not happen, that the emergency program is a first step in getting the people into their permanent houses, and there must be a business plan to show to the MEC this is the time frame over which that will happen. People should not live in containers. The program provides for a very specific minimum standard temporary unit that must be complied with. It was never conceived that people may stay in containers. That is not applicable. That's against the policy. But I don't have the details. A very interesting point made by him, in terms of the low, if you stand a little bit back from South Africa's housing problem, and you look at the Indian magnitude, is that in India, there are 1.1 billion people. Their elite or middle-income people are more than the total population of America. It's just shocking to realize that. Madam, informal land rights are land rights enjoyed by people. They live on state land, but they cannot get individual ownership because it's land that belongs to the state. It's farmland.
township proclamation is not going to take place. They receive permission to occupy or certificates to occupy, or they've lived there for many, many years in terms of some informal right. And that right is protected by the Interim Protection of Land Rights Act, and it will be upgraded to a new order right in terms of CLARA, the Communal Land Rights Act, which has got no own problems. And that is the land rights that we focus on. The lady next to you refers to privately owned land. I'm not too sure what land this is, but we will not be able to provide a subsidy for a person to go and build something on somebody else's land. If it is a farmer's land, we have now got a national housing program to allow farmers, if they want, to draw on subsidy money to provide decent housing for the people that live on the farm. But those people that are private, living on private land, and the farmer is not going to help them, at this moment in time, there's no mechanism that, in terms of which the state can go and help people to build on somebody else's land. It's not possible to do that. So I do realize that that may be a problem. The housing funding is allocated to the 9 provinces in terms of an allocation formula that has been agreed to between the minister and the 9 MECs. There is nothing in the law or in the national housing program that obliges the province to use the funding in a certain way except the national housing programs. The province, the provincial government, has their own ability to decide which program gets what priority and how much funding goes to each program. And therefore, Ralph will have to negotiate with the MEC in terms of an approved need where rollout can go immediately to ring fence a certain amount of the budget over the MTF period. And once they're in the loop, I mean, it will be then additional funding every year. And that's how it works. Currently, our legal system doesn't work that way, that we can prescribe to the province what funding to go. What we do is to say that the bulk of your funding must go for informal settlement upgrading, one or see it in your plans. So we can agree with them in that regard as well. At this moment, we don't know how many people are there and where we have all our ducks in a row to roll out the program. Ralph must still can establish that. And once that is done, we could perhaps then agree with a province or certain provinces to make provision. I think I've addressed most of the comments, if not all. Thank you.
Now, I've always referred to Luke because Mr. Vafanovar is not responding like an official. You are a political. You have to see these things happen. I'm not going to say anything to you. You're not listening. But you have a responsibility to ensure that what is there in the manifesto, what is contained in the manifesto, what is contained in the state of the mission addressed by the president is being implemented. Whatever the provinces are saying, what and that and that and that, everybody should comply. And we are the right person to ensure that those things are being happening.
I think, thanks, Madam Chair. As we have indicated, I think the critical next process is to establish a program and come back and present to you a business plan for implementation and the mechanics and mechanisms that you'll be using to do it. So I think in the next presentation, that's what we'll be doing. I think so that you don't become repetitive and not being action oriented, especially on this particular one.
Honourable members and the DG and your team, we thank you very much for the time you have given yourselves to come before the portfolio committee. And I think your input is very much important to us and is valuable. And it's going to allow us to, I think we are going to interact regularly. And I think as the members of the portfolio committee, now we have got a lot
to report to our constituencies, even in Parliament. We've got a lot to report, statements, questions, and everything. I think this information you're giving to us is going to give us the opportunity to participate in the parliamentary processes. Positively. I'm going to request that after I have attended the meeting, the DG remain behind. We're going to akhululeke. Sale nje uDG yedwa. Isicelo sami eso. The meeting is adjourned. Asale the portfolio committee. The DG and the portfolio committee remain. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
No, but it's a good idea.
Thank you.